Okay, well, to paraphrase the classics, the Chov Vishir is in the building. So, Baruch Hashem, we made it back inside. Parshas Vayera is one of those parshas where everything seems to happen. And I'd like to spend actually a good amount of time considering some aspects of the opening section of the parsha, Avram's famous hosting of the three guests. And we begin at the beginning. Vayera elav Hashem be'enonei mamre. So Hashem appears to Avram, and Rashi comments, Vayera elav, Rashi enlightens us as to the purpose of this visit. Levaker es hachole. Bikocholim, to visit the sick, Amar Rabbi Chama bar Chanina, Yom Shlishi l'milaso hay, it was the third day after the Mila, which is meant to be the difficult day. Uva HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'sha'al b'shlamo, Hashem came and asked and sought to see how Avram was doing. Bikocholim. So this is interesting because formally or seemingly, this is not a halachic teaching. Because the source of mitzvahs are things that Hashem tells us to do. If there is a source in the Torah for the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim, as the Rambam famously says in Hilchos Eivel, in the 14th Perek, it's V'havta Lerecha Kamocha. All of these things, Hachnasas Orchim, Bikur Cholim, they're halachic categories, but they're all really under the rubric of V'havta Lerecha Kamocha as mitzvahs. And yet, this is a halachic source. Noting that HaKadosh Baruch Hu visited Avram does have halachic ramifications for the simple reason that there is another mitzvah, and that is to emulate Hashem, v'halachta b'drachav. As the Gemara says in the end of the first parak of Sota, just as he does such and such, he visits the sick and he buries the deceased, etc., so should you. Mahu afata. And therefore, although this seems to be purely narrative, in nature, it actually is a halachic source, one of the ways to emulate Hashem, just as he was Mevakeh Cholim, so should we. But of course, as is always the case, when dealing with Rashi, we need to ask ourselves why Rashi said what he said. Not only to try and understand what he said, but why he said. Rashi, as we know, never comes to tell us things. He never comes to give us information. If he did, Rashi would be much longer than it is. Rashi's job is liyashiv pshuta shel mikra, to resolve issues in the pshat. And therefore, we must ask, I mean, what is it in this pasuk? The pasuk says Hashem appeared to him, and Rashi says, you know, it's for bikur cholim. Is there some issue in the pasuk? Is there something that Rashi is responding to? This is not the first time Hashem has appeared to Avram. Rashi never felt the need to enlighten us as to what the visit was for. I mean, the words seem to be quite clear, but Rashi feels that we need to say more. Why is this? Well, I think it's fair to say that the simple answer to this question is that in all other cases, in all other visits, the content is clear. Hashem appears to Avram and says the following, whatever he says, Lezarecha etenes aretz hazos, Al tira Avram, or whatever it may be. Here, we have a visit with no message. So there's a blank here. And therefore, Rashi sees fit to fill in the blank and tell us that actually the purpose of the visit was Levaker es hachole. As if to say the pasuk tells us there's a visit but doesn't give us the purpose, that says Darshani. I mean, one needs to really respond to that. And interestingly, if nothing was said, then it tells us that the visit itself sometimes is the goal. In fact, there are some people that they're doing just fine until they open their mouths and ruin everything. So this appears to be the straightforward reasoning. Indeed, the Gemara says that if you visit someone and they're happy to see you, you can take away some of their illness, you can take away what's called the 60th of their illness. That means that their spirits can be buoyed, and their condition can improve. we're fond of relating the episode with the Rebbe. He had money he needed to raise for a worthy cause. And it was a lot of money. So he basically comes to town and he says, "I need to see the richest person in town. I don't have time to waste. I've got to get it as quickly as possible. Who is the biggest, most well-to-do person?" So they said, "He's up on the hill, but you should know, Rebbe, he doesn't give. So if you don't want to waste your time, don't go to him." So the Rebbe said, "I'm going to him." So he knocks on the door. And this person opens the door, sees the Rebbe, of course, invites him in. And after a moment or two, he says, "May I ask, Rebbe, what's the purpose of the visit?" So the Rebbe says, "I've come for a mitzvah." So this person says, "Okay, I see where this is going. This is, I think you haven't heard about me. I don't give. So if the mitzvah is tzedakah, perhaps you should leave." So the Rebbe said, "I didn't come for tzedakah. I came for a different mitzvah." He said, "What other mitzvah could you come for?" So the Rebbe says, "I came for bikur cholim. I came to visit the sick. You're a sick person. I've come to visit you." So this man who was feeling actually quite healthy, he was a bit puzzled. Has someone said that I'm not well? I'm actually quite well. And the Rebbe said, "No, actually, you're quite sick." He says, "How am I sick?" He says, "You're sick. The pasuk in Kohelet says you're sick. Because the verse says, in Kohelet, as one of his reviews of life in the world, he says, 'V'hinei ro'isi ra'a chola,' I've seen a terrible sickness in the world. Osher shamor lebalav lera'oso, a person who has wealth, but he doesn't do the right thing with it. That's a terrible sickness. And you have that disease, so I came for bikur cholim." So this was a bit of a different angle than he was used to, but he recovered a little bit, and he said after a moment, "Okay, Rebbe, even if it's true, let's say I'm sick. Kohelet says I'm sick. I'm not the only sick person in town. There's a lot of sick people. It's a hospital in town. I mean, you really, if you came for bikur cholim, you could have gone there." And the Rebbe says, "I didn't want to go there. The Gemara says, if you visit a sick person, you can take a portion of their sickness. So I don't want any of their sickness. I want some of your sickness." So at that point, he melted. And so it's sometimes... it's the way you go about things. But in any case, so this is bikur cholim. However, just to get back to where we are, if we say the reason why Rashi gives the purpose of the visit of bikur cholim, because the pasuk doesn't elaborate as to what the purpose of the vision was, says the Mizrahi, Rabbeinu Eliyahu Mizrahi, that is not the reason. It sounds so straightforward. It sounds so compelling. But it's not necessarily true. Well, why not? Because, says Mizrahi, if the issue is that we were told that he visited, but we didn't hear the content of the visit, well, maybe we did. Because isn't it true that later on, a few psukim's time, HaKadosh Baruch Hu starts to talk to Avram about his plans for Sodom and Amorah? He says, "Am I withholding from Avram what I'm going to do?" And he starts to talk to him. I'm going to see what will happen with them. And that's, of course, Avram's cue to start davening for them. So there is dialogue, there is content, and therefore this could very well be the content of the visitation. And should you ask, well, it's 20 psukim later, I mean, that's if that's the purpose of the visit, why is it deferred for 20 psukim? Says the Mizrahi, Rashi tells us, Avram deferred it, because although initially he receives the divine presence, but as soon as he sees the guests, so he puts HaKadosh Baruch Hu on hold, so to speak, and says, "Please don't go away until after I've dealt with them." And the ensuing 15, 16 psukim or so, which deal with Avram and the guests, so that, in a sense, is the intermission. That's the interruption. So Avram, in a sense, doesn't allow HaKadosh Baruch Hu to tell him what he appeared to him in order to say. But when the guests have gone, and Avram is then back in session with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he finally is able to tell him what it was that he initially appeared in order to say. Which means, bearing all this in mind, if you want to know, if your problem is what's the content of the visit, the answer is, it's the Pasuk Kaf and Kaf Aleph. And indeed, there are Rishonim who actually explain that way. The Ralbag says, "Vayera Elav Hashem, Hashem appeared to him to say the contents of Pasuk Kaf and Kaf Aleph. But in that case, we're back with our question. So then, if that's the content of the visit, why does Rashi say it was for Bikur Cholim, if that's no longer an issue, and it isn't, as far as the Mizrahi is concerned? Why then does Rashi still feel the need to say, to enlighten us and inform us that the purpose of the visit was Bikur Cholim? Says the Mizrahi, the answer is much closer to home. It is literally staring at us from Pasuk Aleph. And it's a good example of a Pasuk that, for good reason, we're so familiar with it, there may be certain observations that we cease to make. Vayera Elav Hashem. That's how the parsha begins. Hashem appeared to him. So let's ask a Balabata Shashaila. Who's him? Hashem appeared to him. Who's him? Well, obviously, Avram. But why does the Pasuk say him, using the pronoun, and not say Vayera Hashem El Avram? After all, it says Vayera Elav Hashem. It mentions Hashem by name. The rule is, when you start a new parsha or a new section, you can't start with pronouns. You can't start by saying, he said, or he did, or it was to him. You've got to say who you're talking about. Every parsha in the Torah begins, Vayedaber Hashem, El Moshe Lemor. Hashem spoke to Moshe, even if he was just speaking to him. But if it's a new section, you establish your proper nouns, the characters involved. So that's very interesting. Because now the question is a basic pshat question. The pasuk should have said Vayera Hashem El Avram, which it does on other occasions, by the way. How can you start a parsha by talking about him? That's the question. And the answer, says Mizrahi, is, and this is what Rashi is coming to answer. It may seem a bit unusual, and it is, but what is the goal of a pronoun? If you say him, who's he? The one most recently mentioned. Which means Elav, him, is encouraging us to refer back to Avram as most recently mentioned. Well, what is he doing when, as most recently mentioned? He's involved in the Mila. And therefore the Pasuk says Vayera Elav, meaning it's about that. It's about him in that situation, because it was over the Mila. And that's why Rashi says Vayera Elav, and his comments are on the words Vayera Elav. Levaker Esachol. It's apropos of Avram having done the Mila, Yom Shlishi Lemilaso, etc. So once we see what a study it is within Rashi. We know the Rashi and we're familiar with it, Levaker Esachol, etc. But to begin to understand, the more you ask about Rashi, the deeper you look and the more things you notice in the Psukim themselves. Well, as we mentioned, Avram asked HaKadosh Baruch Hu to stay where he was so that Avram can tend to the guests. And that actually is in Pasuk Gimel. Or more correctly, it's one interpretation of Rashi in Pasuk Gimel. Let's see the Pasuk. And this is certainly a case where the only way that I can halachically, acceptably read these words is to read all of them, for reasons that we'll see. Because the pasuk says, "Vayomar Adonai im no matzasichem be'enecha al no ta'avor me'al avdecha." If I found favor in your eyes, please do not pass on from your servant. Who is Avram talking to? That the second word in the pasuk, Aleph Dalet Nun Yud, Rashi gives two interpretations. The first interpretation is that actually he's talking to the guests, because that word is the plural of Adoni. Adoni is my master. And then the plural of that is what is said here. That's Rashi's first interpretation. And it fits in with the flow, the sequential flow of the psukim. He's run towards them, he's bowed down to them, and he starts to speak to them. Of course, the only issue is, it proceeds in the singular, im no matzasichem be'einecha. So, are you addressing all of them, or one of them? But to that, Rashi says, the answer is yes. All of them, and one of them. Meaning, all of them, generally, and then one of them in particular, because Avram understands that one of them is more senior, and if he decides to stay, they'll all decide to stay. Which one of those three was it? Probably the one in the middle. And that's Rashi's first interpretation. However, Rashi is not fully satisfied with that, seemingly, because Rashi goes on to give a second perush, and that is Avram is talking to Hashem. This is the point where Rashi says that Avram says to Hashem, if you don't mind, please don't leave. I'm going to tend to the guests, and then I'll be back. That's where he said it. Which means the second word in this pasuk, Aleph Daladud Yud, is Avram addressing Hashem. That's why it's hard to know how to read it. Because if you read it as Hashem, that means it's Hashem Kodesh. But if you read it Aleph Dalet Nun Yud, it's Hashem Chol. And Rashi gave two interpretations. The question is, what would move Rashi to give this second interpretation that Avram is talking to Hashem? Bear in mind, if that's true, then the psukim are out of sequence because he's already started running. And now he starts talking. Pasuk Beis, he's already running, he's already bowing. So he's davening on the run, it sounds like, unless you say that the psukim are non-sequential, which is a drastic thing to say. So why not just leave it? Leave it with the first perush. He's talking to all of them, and leave it at that. The answer, says Rabbeinu Bachya, and it's interesting because it's easier to navigate this part of the discussion if you're Ashkenazi, even though it's conducted by Rabbeinu Bachya, who was Hadayan HaSfaradi. And that is, if you're talking to the plural of Adoni is actually Adonai, with a patach, not with a kamatz. That word with a kamatz, noi, that's reserved for Hashem. As we see, actually, in our own parsha, because when Lot addresses the malachim in the plural in Perik, they come to Sodom, and Lot approaches them and invites them in. And he says in Pasuk, Perek Yutes Pasuk Beis, Vayomer, Hine no Adonai, my masters. The plural of Adoni is Adonai. But our Pasuk has a komatz. That's Shem Kodesh. So once you mention that point, it actually becomes very difficult to understand Rashi's first perush, because he says it's the plural of Adoni. What's it doing with the komatz? Well, Maharal says, if you look at the Tamei HaMikra on this word, it's a revi'i, which is a bit of a pause. And as we know, a patach word, when it's a pausal form, when it comes at the end of a sentence or the end of a significant phrase, so the patach changes to a komatz. Like we say in last week's parsha, Vayetzu laleches artza kena'an, vayavo artza kena'an. Because at the end, Kana'an becomes Kana'an. And therefore, maybe the word really should be Adonai, if it's plural for my masters, plural of Adoni. What's it doing with the comments? Because it's a pause. Because it's a pause. Okay. But this is now the launch of a fascinating discussion of Rabbeinu Bachya himself. Namely, why is it that when the Aleph Daled Nun Yud refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, so why does it have a komatz? Always, if that's meant to be for a pausal form, but we're not always pausing. It could be anywhere in the sentence, we'll always have a komatz. And here, Rabbeinu Bachya opens up the whole discussion, the whole sugya of the vowels of the words. As far as we're concerned, what's the purpose of the vowels of the words? What did they do? They tell you how to pronounce it, and that's that. Says Rabbeinu Bachya, there's more. He cites the Sefer HaBahir. The Sefer HaBahir is an early Kabbalistic work. And the Sefer HaBahir says that the relationship of the vowels to the letters is analogous to the relationship between the neshama and the guf, between the soul and the body. And that's why in the Sefer Torah, all you see are the letters, because when you look at a person, all you see is the guf. But there's something else there. There's something else animating them. There's something else characterizing them. That's the vowels. The vowels are the character. They represent the personality, so to speak, of the word. So, what does this mean? For our purposes, Rabbeinu Bachya focuses on the patach and the komatz. What's the difference in atmosphere? What's the difference in what's being denoted by a patach and a komatz? Well, the difference conveniently is that the commas is effectively an elevated patach. I mean, it's a patach on a stand. And what this denotes, says Rabbeinu Bachya, is that a komatz indicates some type of elevation, some type of significance of the word that it's describing. It's very interesting. If you have a patach word, it's flat, it's relatively lower level. Komatz word, relatively elevated. That sounds rather abstract, says Rabbeinu Bachya. That will explain to us the very phenomenon that we just referred to. Namely, that a patach word, when it comes at the end of a sentence or at the end of a significant phrase, it changes to a komatz. Why? Is it because it's easier to pronounce? It isn't. It's the same word. But what's happened is, says Rabbeinu Bachya, that when it's the final word, it could be the final word of the sentence, be the final word of a significant phrase, so that finality gives it completion. And as the word that completes, it therefore has added chashivus, added significance, added weight. This is, it's literally the final word. And therefore, in view of its status as the mashlim, as the completing word, which now gives you a complete entity, so the word itself gets upgraded, we would say, or promoted. It could be, in normal circumstances, it's a patach word. But in this very chashiva situation, it itself attains greater chashivus and becomes promoted to a komatz word. It's very interesting. I don't think we'd ever thought about the pausal form, if we even thought about it at all, to think about it in that way. Normally, laws of dikduk l'chud and laws of everything else l'chud. I think for many people, their approach to dikduk discussions is to keep their head down, avoid eye contact, and wait till it's over. But says Rabbeinu Bachya, no, because there's a certain spiritual atmospheric happening that's reflected, and a patach word can become promoted to a komatz word. By the same token, or conversely, says Rabbeinu Bachya, a komatz word can become demoted. How does that ever happen? There is something called the construct form, the something of something, which means that if the Hebrew word for father is of, actually, it's of with a komatz, but the father of someone is av, like av harachamim. Or the Hebrew word for hand is yod, with a komatz also, but the hand of someone is yad, yad Moshe. Not biyad Moshe. Dovar becomes devar, devar Torah, or whatever it will be. And that's really the idea of the construct form. So once again, the pronunciation changes. But why? Why does it go down in this instance from komatz to patach? Because it's been demoted. Why has it been demoted? Because it's lost its significance. It's lost its independence. It's not an independent word. It is literally relies on the word after it to finish its description. And because it's reliant on another word and it loses its self-sufficiency, so it goes down a notch. And a komatz goes down to a patach. So all of a sudden, the ebbs and flows and rises and falls of the komatz and the patachs, they're actually all related to this question of chashivus versus non-chashivus. Now, ad kan, we're relatively in safe territory because we are discussing why the rules of grammar work the way they do because of this personality idea of how the vowels are. But there is one occasion mentioned by Rabbeinu Bachya where the inner understanding of the vowels, it doesn't explain the rules of grammar. It breaks the rules of grammar. When does that happen? In Sefer Shmuel Beis, in the beginning of Shmuel Beis, so what is happening there? Shmuel Aleph ended with the war with Shaul and the enemy, and he was killed. No one knows. Shmuel Beis's David and his camp is waiting to hear news from the war. They don't know what's happened. And someone comes along to inform them, someone who was in the war. He's referred to as a Nar Amaleki. and he made a calculation. Actually, Shaul took his own life. That seems to be what happened, which is part of a bigger halachic question. How is it permissible to do that? Did he fear the national disgrace or whatever it may be? Had he fallen into the hands of the enemy? It's a very complicated question. But in any event, but this person felt that he knew that Shaul and David had a history, and he knew that Shaul had pursued David to kill him on more than one occasion. Therefore, he reasoned, no one knows what happened. If I now present myself as someone who killed Shaul, David's enemy, so that will curry favor with him, and who knows? Hopefully I'll be rewarded, a place in his government, or any type of reward. And therefore, he fabricated a story whereby he said that he killed Shaul. It wasn't true, but no one knew. And that's what he said. He said the enemy was getting closer. Vo'e'emodalav. I stood over him, I killed him. It's not true. But he thought it would work out well for him. In the event, as the Psukim described, David believed him and killed him for killing Shaul. So, in retrospect, it wasn't the best career move. but that's what he said. Now, why is this of relevance to us? If we look again at those words, those three words. Vo'e'emodalav. Something's amiss here. What could it be? Well, the vav is the vav ahipuch, right? It flips the future to the past. I did this, I did this. When the vav ahipuch is before an aleph, or any of those gutturals, but before an aleph, it's a komatz. And vo'e'emod, for example, is perfect, meaning it's before an aleph, and therefore it's a komatz. Vo'e'emod. By the same token, the second word, when I killed him, should have said vo'amos aseihu. It's before an aleph. Just like the vav of vo'e'emodus komatz, so the vav of vo'amos aseihu should be komatz. But it isn't. It's a patach. Why? No one can explain it. Says Rabbeinu Bachya, you know why it's a patach and not a komatz? Because it was a lie. Because it was such a low thing to say, to have claimed to have killed Shaul. So the laws of grammar, we have a machlokas now, between the laws of grammar and the laws of morals. And grammar says, should be a komatz here. And moral says, never. A word like that, such a despicable thing to say, vamosaseyu, it's almost like the grammatically correct komatz is confiscated. The leg of the komatz is confiscated, and it receives a dishonorable patach, which is absolutely unbelievable. Because here we see that the inner workings of the komatz and the patach are breaking through, and for once, the laws of grammar were broken. That provided, I think, inspiration for many people to do that on other occasions, mostly unintentionally. But it really is an unbelievable thing. And therefore, coming back to our situation, says Rabbeinu Bachya, if you wish to know why, when the name Aleph Dalet Nun Yud refers to Hashem, it's always with a komatz, you have your answer. If it refers to Hashem, right, the highest of the high, that's a komatz, it's not a patach word. And that's why it bears a komatz. So it's fascinating to see how from this one pasuk in the beginning of Parshas Vayera, we see a concept that really now runs through the entire Tanakh, all of Lashon HaKodesh, certainly something to look out for. It's something that we discussed on other occasions, because I believe one can identify other anomalies which can be explained based on this idea, but that's something that we'll leave for another time. So what does Avram say to these men? We're not surging through the parsha here. What does he say in Pasuk Gimel? He beseeches them. So what does he say in Pasuk Dalet? Yukachnama at Maim. Let a bit of some water be taken. Rechatzu Aglechem. Wash your feet. Vishanu Tachas Ha'etz. Make yourselves comfortable under the tree. Kofas Lechem. I'll take some bread. Vasudu Sadu Libchem. Eat your heart's content. Achar Taveru. After that you can... you can go on your way. In other words, if you're already here, that's my invitation. Okay, Avram's famous invitation, and it's famous because it's the third day after his Mila, and he pursues them. And their response is quite amazing. I don't think it's a standard guest response. What do they say? Bayomru, kein ta'aseh ka'asher dibarta. Yes, do as you said. That doesn't seem to be the normal etiquette when an invitation has been extended. Would you like to stay? Yes, prepare the room. And do it now. So that's what they're saying. But why? And many Mefarshim ask this question. It's a very, very direct. Doesn't seem to be in the host's in the guest's guidebook. That's not the recommended response. But that's what they say. So the Al-Sheikh HaKadosh explains that it's interesting that Avram he mentions so many details. Actually, he says take some water. You can put yourself under the tree. I'll take some bread, and then you can go. And why is he saying all these things? So actually, what Avram, the Al-Sheikh explains, Al-Sheikh HaKadosh, that what Avram is doing is that he's actually looking, in a sense, to preempt any reason that they might have for refusing his offer. And there are any numbers of reasons why a guest may refuse the offer for a host, even a good guest, not just out of bad feeling, but even out of good feeling. Firstly, says the Al-Sheikh, they may not wish to put him out. They may genuinely not wish to trouble him if they see that it's trouble for Avram and they don't wish to trouble him. Alternatively, not only the trouble of taking care of them, but when you bring a guest into the house, so then the house needs to be in order. And the house isn't always in order. I mean, the house needs to look like no one lives there, and only then can actually guests enter there. So maybe they might not wish to trouble him. They don't know what state this house is, and maybe they don't wish to be the cause of expense for him. I mean, if they are themselves of means, why should he be anyway out of pocket? And apart from anything else, says the Al-Sheikh, sometimes guests are in a hurry. Sometimes people are in a hurry. So you say, would you like to go? I'd like to, but I need to be somewhere. So these are all the reasons that with the best will in the world, people might say no. And that's why Avram has this perfect invitation where he's actually addressed each of these potential concerns in advance. What's the first thing he says to them is, Yukachna ma'at mayim. Someone can bring you water, as if to say, you don't have to worry about me troubling myself. There's many people here and they're all happy to help. So it's no trouble. That's the first thing. Secondly, he says, you don't even need to come into the house. You don't have to worry about what type of state my house is in. You can make yourselves comfortable under the tree. Everything's there already. He also says, ve'ekhof haslechem. I'll take a bit of bread. In other words, he doesn't tell them what he has in store for them. He says, I'll take some bread. Some bread doesn't cost that much money. I mean, that's not an expense. In the end, of course, he gave them a whole banquet. But in terms of his invitation, I'll take a bit of bread. That should be okay. And then he says, achar ta'averu, after you can go. And achar, as we know, for Rashi, as opposed to acharei, achar means, and you can be on your way straight away. That's the difference between achar and acharei. Rashi told us in last week's parsha, achar is somuch, straight away, afterwards, immediately afterwards, and acharei is muflag, a while afterwards. And what Avram is saying is, he's not looking to hurry them, but if they're on their way somewhere, he's saying, I'm not going to detain you. As soon as you want to move on, you've got to eat. As soon as you want to move on, you absolutely can. And therefore, what Avram has described is as little trouble as a person could go to in order to host guests, in order to make them accept the invitation. And that's why, says the Al-Sheikh, when they say, kein ta'aseh kasher dibarta, yes, do as you said, what they're saying is, we accept, but only if it's as you said, meaning only if it's no trouble, and only if we don't need to enter the house, and only if you don't bring us too much, and then we're not going to detain you by staying for a while. That's why they say, kein ta'aseh kasher dibarta. I hope that you stick to your minimalistic invitation, which of course he didn't, but by then it was too late. So these are the Al-Sheikh's parshanut comments with regards to Avram's invitation. But I would like to focus on, once again, on a Rashi. In Pasuk Hey. And I think it's a Rashi that one could gloss over. In fact, I know it is, because I've glossed over it many times. until I noticed it yesterday, and I think there's a major yusod within this Rashi. And interestingly, it's not even the full comment of Rashi; it's at the tail end of one of his comments on the words in Pasuk Hey, "V'sa'adu libchem." And satiate your hearts, or eat your heart's content, or whatever it is. And so Rashi first establishes how bread satiates the heart, and he brings certain psukim. And in the end of the comment, Rashi says, Amar Rabbi Chama, he's quoting the Medrash Rabbah, Precious Rabbah, Amar Rabbi Chama, Levavchem ein ksiv kan. It doesn't say levavchem, v'sa'adu levavchem. Rather, ela libchem, v'sa'adu libchem. What's the difference between sa'adu levavchem and sa'adu libchem? Well, as we know, or in Rashi, let's say Rashi's words first, Magid teaches us, she'en yetzahara, showed it by Malachim, that Malachim don't have a yetzahara. As if to say the two bases when you have the word levav, or levavachem, like we say, b'chol levavacha, b'shnei yitzarecha, yitzotov and yitzara, the two bases within the word levav represent the two inclinations, yitzotov and yitzara. Libchem, with the one base, there's only one inclination. It's just yitzotov. So that's an interesting diktuk, or diuk, that comes out, sa'adu libchem, as opposed to sa'adu levavachem. What is so interesting about this comment of Rashi, I mean, aside from the comment itself. We have discussed on a number of occasions that we need to be very alert whenever we see that the Torah quotes someone speaking. Because if we ask the very simple sounding question, whose words are these? The Torah can quote Avram speaking. The Torah can quote Esav speaking. It can quote Paro speaking. And Bilam. So who's speaking? And when you see this in the Torah, whose words are these? And by which we mean? Every word in the Torah is part of the Torah. And if the Torah is missing even a letter, it's possible. And even if the letter that is missing is a letter from a sentence that Esav said, the Sefer Torah is possible, because the Torah wants you to know what Esav said. But at the same time, it's Esav who said it. And not everything Esav says is necessarily endorsed by the Torah. It's not something that the Torah would say should happen, but it did happen, and it happened by someone who doesn't care about the Torah. Esav said, I'm going to kill Yaakov. The Torah, it's in the Torah. It's not a Torah value, but it's part of what the Torah wants you to know. But really what that means is we need to factor in that if these are Esav's words, and he's saying something which isn't even morally correct, so is there a difference? Is there a difference between Esav's words, as brought to you in the Torah, and the Torah's words, when it says, for example, don't murder, in Aseret HaDibros? And the answer, unavoidably, is yes. And in fact, sometimes you can see it very clearly, even if you need to see it, you can see it clearly, because sometimes the Torah actually has already told you what happened, and then it tells you what a person said happened, and the two don't match up. Which basically tells you that what this person is saying is not what happened, because the Torah has already told you. But the Torah wants you to know how he said it. It's part of Torah to know how he said it, but it's not of what the Torah itself says. And it's all part of the Sefer Torah, and nothing can go missing. What's a classic example of this? Paro's dream, in the beginning of Parshas Miketz. So how does it begin? Miketz, Shnosayim Yamim. Paro's dream, V'inei Omeid Al HaYor. He's standing over the... Okay. Now, we happen to hear Paro retelling his dreams to Yosef, but we've already heard them from the Torah itself, and the two are not exactly the same. And there's a reason why there are differences. And even in that matter, for example, when he says to Yosef, Bachalumi, well, you know what's happening in my dream? Hinani omeid al svas hayor. I was standing by the banks of the Nile. That's not true. It's not true in the sense that we already know that in his dream he wasn't standing on the banks of the Nile, he was standing over the Nile. He may have had reason not to wish to tell that to Yosef, especially if the Nile was a deity, so even though it's a dream, he may be conscious of the fact that he's telling a complete stranger that he dreamt that he's on top of the deity that they're all meant to be worshipping, and that might be uncomfortable for him, and therefore he places himself on the banks of the Nile, even though it's not true. Which means, if you want to know, where was he in his dream? The answer is, the Torah has told you, it's over the Nile. But you also need to know what he said, because the Torah wants you to learn from him. This is what a person does when they're embarrassed or egotistical or whatever it may be. And the irony really can be summed up, therefore, by saying that if a sofer wrote the Sefer Torah and missed out the word Sfas in Parah's account, it would be closer to the truth, and the whole Sefer Torah is possible. Because the Torah at this point doesn't want you to know what's in his dream. The Torah has already told you that. It wants you to know what Parah said is in his dream, and you didn't do that. And clearly, therefore, not everything that is said in the Torah is endorsed by the Torah, but it's included in the Torah because the Torah wants you to learn from it. However, there is a synthesis here that needs to be done. Because even if it's true, and it's undeniably true, that when the Torah quotes someone, assuming that we don't take a Kabbalistic approach, we take a historical approach, the simple approach of the Torah, when it quotes someone, so those words came from that person, and they're quoted as such, whatever, for better or for worse, whatever they said they were going to do, a mitzvah or an aveira, if they're telling the truth or lying, that may well be. But at the end of the day, it's in the Torah. And what that means is, it could be that the Torah wants you to know what they said, but the Torah has a way of speaking. And even when the Torah wants you to know what they said, the Torah will present it in the way the Torah talks about things, even when it's saying what they said. Which means the parameters of how the Torah describes things will be equally employed when it quotes people, because it wants you to know what they said, but the Torah has a language, and the Torah uses its own language even when it quotes them. And what that means is that every word and every letter in the Torah can now be expanded on many levels, but that can only be if the Torah wrote it in the Torah way. If the Torah left it as a direct quote from them, since when can their words be expanded on multiple levels? Sometimes their words can barely be expanded on any level. But all of a sudden, it could be, you can learn it through Drash and Remez and Sod and all of that, because it's gone through the system of how the Torah writes, and now it's the Torah, even as it's describing other people. There is a fascinating illustration of this idea. It's found in the writings of the Ben Ish Chai, the Rabbi Yosef Chaim of Baghdad, the great Sfardi Godel, I would say Posek, but he was more than a Posek, a great, outstanding figure. And he has a commentary on Agadah called Ben Yehoyada. And he addresses one of the section in the Gemara where it talks about Tfilas Chana. Tfilas Chana, which is her prayer for a child, it's the Haftarah for the first day of Rosh Hashanah. And she says many things, and the Gemara darshans a lot of what she says. And at one stage, how does she begin? She says, Imra o tir'esh, addressing Hashem, Imra o tir'eh ba'ani amasecha, if you will see the affliction of your maidservant and give me a child, then I'll dedicate him, etc. Imra o tir'eh, double expression. What are we to make of this double expression? Whenever there's a double expression, we're on guard. Ra'o tir'em. And in fact, there are some opinions in the Gemara who expound it. Ra'o means this, tir'em means this, and it's all expounded. But there's another opinion that doesn't expound it. Why? Because that opinion says, I don't expound double-barreled phrases. Because Dibra Torah Kolosha B'nei Adam, you know, the Torah speaks the way people speak. and people speak that way, for emphasis. They double things over. when they say one thing, they say it twice already. Being of Irish descent, I can relate to that. To be sure. So people speak that way. And in this instance, or with reference to this, Dibra Torah Kolashim B'Ne'atam, the Torah speaks the way people speak, in his opinion, in his approach. And therefore, if you see an expression like Ro Terem, leave it. It means what it means. It doesn't mean two things. It means one thing. Okay, that's a machlokas that runs through Torah now, because there's many doubled over expressions. Hocheach tochiach, so on and so forth. Aser to aser. Fine, it's a machlokas. Rabbi Yosef Chaim of Baghdad asked such a simple question. Because what are we saying? Look at the words Ro'o Tire. It's a double-barreled phrase. You're going to expound it? Some people do, but others don't. Why? Because the Torah speaks the way people speak. And people, they double things over. So because he subscribes to that idea, he doesn't get involved in darshaning it. Says the Ben Ish Chai, listen, there may be a machlokas as to whether the Torah speaks like people. But one thing you can be quite sure, people speak like people. And it's a person talking. This is Hannah talking. It's not a pasuk, meaning that is to say, it's not the Navi narrating, or it's not the Torah speaking. The Torah is quoting her. She's a person. So there may be a machlokas as to whether the Torah speaks the way people do, but people certainly speak the way people do. They're people. So how can there even be this machlokas? As if to say, if your position when it comes to the way people speak is not to make anything out of it, so all should agree here not to darshan it, because it's a person. It's a very disarming question. What's the answer? The answer is, says the Ben Ish Chai, it may well be that people double over their expressions. But once someone is quoted by the Torah, you're not going to see a double expression, and you're not going to be able to leave it unless you subscribe to the idea that the Torah speaks like people. Because if you understand that the Torah doesn't speak like people, then maybe she would have doubled over the expression, but the Torah won't unless it wants you to learn something from it. And therefore the only way, the only opinion in that situation who says don't expound it as a double thing, it's a loop. It's if the Torah speaks like people. Because, it's the Torah speaking, but if the Torah speaks like people, so then you can leave it alone. But barring that, it's the Torah speaking. It's not a person speaking anymore, because it's been formatted in the expression of the Torah. If there's a double expression, and you subscribe to darshaning those, you'll darshan them even when the Torah is quoting a person. And this teaches us that, and it's, I think it's a very profound idea that runs through all of the Torah's quotations of people. On the one hand, yes, it's the person speaking in the sense that whatever's being presented came from the person, and the Torah wants you to know what they said, but the way the Torah presents it, that's already, the Torah has its lexicon, and the Torah has its parameters, and the Torah has its modes of expression. They'll be used when it quotes people as surely as when it's the Torah itself speaking. Why do I mention this here? All of this was triggered by this Rashi yesterday. Why? Because back to our Rashi, v'sadu libchem, and Rashi gets involved in aitzes libchem, right? Not levavchem. Well, what does that mean? What it means is, again, in the Medrash's words that Rashi quotes, Amar Bichama, levavchem engsid kan. It doesn't say levavchem, ela libchem. With one base. Magid, to teach us, teaches you something about angels. She'en yetzahara sholeit b'malachim. They don't have a yetzahara. Okay. Now you know. What's so significant about this comment of Rashi? He's commenting on something that Avram said. This is Avram's words of invitation. Avram doesn't know that they're malachim. Because if you check back in the previous pasuk, Pasuk Dalet, he tells them to wash their feet. And he tells them to wash their feet because he thinks that they are idol-worshipping nomads. That's his impression of them. And so it should be. As if to say, he's not meant to know that they're malachim. Everything changes. If he wants to bring in guests and he knows that they're malachim, so It's not the same. And in fact, Rashi even tells us when the whole thing is over, Avraham Olechim Am L'Shalcham, he accompanies them. And Rashi makes a point of saying, he thought they're normal guests, Kasavor She'orchim Him. He thinks they're normal guests, even after everything, which is itself quite amazing, because not only is this even after they've been in his house, but it's also even after one of them issued a blessing that Sarah, his 89-year-old wife, will have a baby next year, which is not standard for normal guests. And then when she laughs, Hashem intervenes. So clearly, that should have seemingly would be an indication that there's. But be that as it may, Rashi makes a point of saying even when it's all over and he accompanies them, he thinks they're normal guests. So if he thinks they're normal guests, so why is he telling us that Malachim don't have a Yetzer Hara? What's that got to do with anything? These people probably do, because they're human beings as far as he's concerned. So we're in a fascinating situation, because there's a nuance from Avram's words that addresses an aspect of the situation that he thinks is the opposite is the case. But I believe that the way to understand it is exactly as we've been saying. Namely, Avram thinks that they are nomads. So, and by the way, without getting too practical, because we don't want anything to go missing with the practicalities, but if he thinks they're, what is Rashi's words? Kasavor shem Arabim, he thinks they're Arabs who bow down to their, I don't know what Arabs looked like in those days, how many sorts there were. He probably didn't address them in Hebrew. And it's only really in Hebrew that the difference between one base and two bases comes. So one thing's for sure, it's got to be translated either way, is Lashon HaKodesh. But that shouldn't be an oversimplification, because even if that's true, but let it be translated in the way that he said it, and yet we see that that's not what's happening. As if to say, the Torah wants you to know everything that he said, and by the time we're finished, you know everything that he said. And what's more, you know more. Because the Torah has its own things that it wants to tell you, using Avram's words. If he were to say this in Hebrew, he probably would have said Levavchem. But the Torah doesn't want to tell you Levavchem. And in the way that he said it, it doesn't make a difference. But he probably would not have chosen Libchem, which is appropriate for angels, because he doesn't know that they're angels. That may well be. But in a sense, the Torah has taken over, because this is the Torah. And as much as it wants you to know what it said, but the Torah has its own way of saying, because the Torah wants you to teach you things in addition to telling you what Avram said. And you have this incredible blend now. And I think there's an interesting diuk in Rashi, because he quotes the Medrash, again, to read these words for the third time, Amr Bichama, Levavchem ein ksivkan. Levavchem is not written here. Ela Libchem. Libchem is written here. So what's so interesting about the Rashi? Rashi's not talking about what Avram said. Rashi's talking about what's written. He's not talking... Rashi doesn't say, Lo amar levavchem ela libchem. Rashi doesn't say what he didn't say and what he did say. Rashi's talking about what is written here and what is not written here. Because he's addressing... Pshuta shel mikra is how the Torah is telling you this. And the Torah wants to give you another message. That's about what's katuv. What did Avram say? Satiate your hearts in whatever language he said it. It's got nothing to do with this. The Torah tells you everything that Avram said, plus Katuv Kan, something else, that the Torah gives you as a bonus message, as an additional layer, because the Torah is darshan on all of these levels, and that's to teach you this idea. So the irony, in a sense, is that the Torah teaches us about Malachim using words that were said by someone who didn't know that they were Malachim. Okay, that certainly needs to be pondered and reflected upon. But in any case, so we really stayed very much within, I think, the first opening psukim, and only really scratched the surface, but certainly many ideas well worthy of our reflection and consideration. We'll leave it over.